That's the great Clark Terry with Trumpet Mouthpiece Blues. That's right, it's just mouthpiece. He recorded it in 1957, and it appears on his 1958 album, Out on a Limb with Clark Terry. Of course, there are other great sidemen as well. Mike Simpson on saxophone and flute, Remo Biondi on guitar, Willie Jones on piano, Jimmy Wood on bass, and Sam Woodyard on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and it is Free Your Mind Friday. This is where you take the conversation wherever you want to go, and I'm hoping that you have a strong opinion about something. We'll see how people react to what you offer, and we'll start right now at 888-874-4888. Walter from Virginia, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrice. How are you?
Hello. Fine, thank you, Walter. How are you?
I am well, and greetings to the Utrice Lead PRN family of listeners. It's been a while since I called, and I just had to call in this week because your commentary early in the week about the Stephon Clark and other police violent shooting situations had just compelled me to call in, because your commentaries are like Drano for the mind. They unblock what's going on there so that new thoughts can flow. And so some new thoughts have flowed, and so I wanted to speak about those today.
Well, thank you. So let's hear what you're saying.
Well, much like yourself, I'm fairly frustrated with basically always talking about the various problems that we have with police violence and race. I mean, we've actually talked those problems into the ground, and now I'm at a point where, as you know, it just pains me to listen to the rehashing of the situations, basically from a standpoint of hopelessness. And when you had spoken about Al Sharpton and Benjamin Crump and those resources being the ones that were predominantly available to the grieving families and to the victims' families, it made me really think, you know, we have all of this talent out there within our community, and we haven't tried to or haven't pooled that talent together to make a creative solution. So now I'm from the standpoint of, you know, I'm tired of discussing and hearing about the problem. I want to hear creative and innovative solutions, and ones that are not based on hopelessness.
What in particularly struck you as hopeless?
Well, hopeless from the standpoint that we have to go for a settlement rather than justice, whereas we couldn't possibly use one to get the other. What do I mean by that? In many respects, it took a Malcolm to have a Martin, and a Martin to have a Malcolm, in the sense of a good cop, bad cop type of deal. You can either deal with me or you could deal with him. And that kind of standpoint could happen in terms of us going after settlements versus going after justice in terms of litigation. And I think one of the reasons that we have that hopelessness of just having to throw up our hands and taking a settlement, which is more or less going to be whatever they choose to give us, is one that we are not considered a threat. And so there is no reason for the system or the power structure that be to deal with us in any other way. They're going to give us the means of least resistance on their behalf. So what I was thinking of, and you always talk about plans, and you always talk about systems, so that we can now start to think about creating and organizing to construct a plan to develop a mechanism, or i.e. a system, in order to deal with police brutality, police violence, police killing in the black community. And that plan or that mechanism or that system whereby would have several components. It would have a legal or litigation component, but first and foremost, it would have a funding component, a funding source, where we have a mastermind session of some of the most brilliant minds in this country that are great at raising funds, are great at doing social media campaigns to raise funds, so that there's a continuous funding source that can feed the other components of litigation, ones of accounting services to make sure that the money is accounted for and there's proper stewardship of the money. There would be a political component of that to basically put fire under the belly of those folks in the Congressional Black Caucus and in other parts of Congress so that there is a legislative arm on that so that our issues are presented in or kept present in the Congress. Then there would be a media component of that, which we pretty much have already as far as folks marching in the street and being on various television and radio programs to keep those issues in front of the public.
Well, I think you're off to a very good start with your thinking on this issue, and we have to invest time and energy and creativity and effort in bringing, as you said, bringing together something that looks like a system, because they have a system. The system is there. We are fighting it all the time. And we don't seem to have a system of our own. So this is a subject I think we should explore more. But I'm glad that you thought about it and you see the sense that it makes. So thank you for getting us started today. And let us hope that we can continue this discussion without people, you know, thinking, well, we just try to be cantankerous. Yeah, no, it's about a system because we're dying.
And I just want to interject this last point because, in my view, the civil rights movement was more than just a movement of people feeling good. It was a system to counteract racism, whereby they had various components or various arms, if you will, or branches of legal, congressional, as well as media.
Yes, and the thing is that imagine this was a situation in which these things were literally imposed upon them. The situation of life, they had to deal with it. And they did their best to put it together in a systematic way. We can't discount the importance of having a system. You're fighting a system, you got to have a system. Very important. Thank you for your call today. We go to Berkeley. Harvey, you're there.
Hi, wonderful Utrees. How are you today?
Hey, good. How are you, Harvey?
Great, great. Well, I recently read an article about Swiss Reinsurance. That's an insurance company that insures other insurance companies. And they said that the worldwide insurance losses from environmental disasters topped $114 billion in 2017, the highest on record and twice as much as 2016. And much of this economic damage came from large hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, and wildfires. And it's a tough time for the insurance companies, and it's going to get a lot worse in my estimation, which means that home and car insurance is going to cost us a lot more in the near future to compensate for the industry's losses. So I believe that it's time for the insurance industry to incentivize the American people and commercial building owners by lowering their insurance rates if they reduce their carbon footprint. And we can reduce our carbon footprint by investing in solar rooftop installations and buying electric vehicles and plugging them into our solar electric rooftops to help slow the burning of fossil fuels that produce carbon dioxide, which is accelerating climate destabilization. And I think it's time for us to get star powered. I say let's get solar and to save the insurance companies and respect our home planet. Because Earth is mama.
Very good idea that you have. How do you think it will be received in the insurance world?
Well, you know, they have to make, you know, unless they want to go broke, because climate destabilization, especially under the Trump administration, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of the fossil fuel industry, is just going to get worse and worse, because the more carbon dioxide in the air, It creates more heat, and that creates more evaporation from the ocean. And once the you get more evaporation, it turns out that water vapor is actually the biggest of all the greenhouse gases. And so it's just like if you put a pot of boiling water on the stove and you turn up the heat, the water boils faster and faster and faster. And that's what's happening with our climate. It's just moving around faster and faster and faster because of all this climate destabilization, which causes bigger hurricanes, bigger tornadoes, bigger monsoons, and destabilizes the climate, which means more droughts, which create, like here in California, which create massive wildfires and also flooding. And so you'll have, it's disaster. It's absolutely disaster. So we really have to move away from fossil fuels. We have the technology, and now's the time for the insurance companies to step up and to help us do that and also save their own business at the same time.
Thanks a lot. Always something to think about. We can count on you for that, Harvey. Thank you so much for calling today.
Thank you.
Let's go to Bill from New Jersey. You're on the air, Bill.
Good afternoon, Eutrice.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good, good. How about yourself?
I'm hanging in there.
Good. Something I've been wanting to talk about, I actually tried to call in last Friday, but I wasn't able to get through, which was sparked by the conversation over Winnie Mandela, who I've wanted to speak about for some time, ever since you mentioned her, I think it was a couple of months ago, and, you know, how prophetic that she would pass certainly after that, but you had mentioned that we needed to speak about her. And we do, and I believe she deserves more than a day or two. She deserves a week. So here we go. I believe that people in general, but specifically black people in this country, need to do a better job of choosing their heroes. For far too long, we have allowed someone else to give us heroes, to say, here's your hero, here's the one that you revere, here's who you should follow, here's who, you don't choose your own. They tell you, Martin Luther King, this is the guy you should revere, because the whole nonviolent thing, not Malcolm, no, don't pay any attention to him. Don't pay any attention to Odetta. Don't pay any attention to Ida B. Wells. Don't pay any attention to these people. Martin Luther King, because he was nice and he believed in taking the beat down and somehow that would free black people, which is a ridiculous premise as far as I'm concerned. I mean, supposedly he got it from Gandhi, but we were not in the same situation as Gandhi. Gandhi was in his country. He had the numbers by far, and the people were willing to die for him. And the power structure, the British, knew that if they let him die, the people would kill them. The people would run amok and kill them all, which is why they had to deal with him. So we didn't have the same situation. But I believe that Nelson Mandela and Winnie are a similar situation. Follow Nelson. He's your hero. Don't pay any attention to Winnie, because Winnie was about armed struggle. That Nelson Mandela started out was very much about armed struggle before he went to prison. Winnie stayed strong in that, knowing that if you don't fight and drive the oppressor out of your country, you will never be free. You'll never be free by negotiating and making a deal where you allow the oppressor to keep everything. Keep everything. It's all yours. Let us act like we're free, and let us vote, and we'll forgive you, and you keep everything. That's not freedom. And that's what broke Nelson and Winnie Mandela up, because she didn't like that deal that Nelson made. And by the way, big up to Jose a couple of weeks ago talking about how Nelson Mandela came out of prison compromised. he said it in a nice way. I'm going to say it plain, that Nelson Mandela was the biggest sellout of African people in history. He sold them out. He made a deal that sold them out. It's disgusting, the deal that he made. And if people want to get some more history on that, there's a very good movie, Mandela and de Klerk, that came out in 1997. Very few people saw it, but it was starring Sidney Poitier as Mandela. It was written by Sidney Poitier's screenwriter that did several of his movies. So, in other words, Sidney Poitier was very instrumental to the production, and it was based off of interviews with Mandela, and quite a few things are exposed in this movie that people don't know, not the least of which is the whole idea that Mandela spent 27 years on Robben Island in hard labor is false. He did not spend 27 years on Robben Island. He spent 21 years in prison, but quite a few of those years were spent at a private prison that they built for him, which was a luxury house with a pool and a cook. He was the only prisoner there. They kept him there for years while they talked over a deal, how they would calm the swell of removing apartheid. And basically, they made a deal with him. They carted him all around the country and negotiated. And that's the deal that he made. And by the way, when he left Robben Island, he didn't take any of his compatriots with him. He left them all behind and went to his private prison without them. People should look at that movie and see the real story of Mandela and how he made this deal. He came out of prison brainwashed and broken, made a deal to sell out his country, and that's why they're in the state they are in now. They don't have freedom. They've never had freedom. And anyone that thinks that they do have freedom should look back at several years ago. The people tried to strike in the mines, in the diamond mines, and what did they do? They shot them. They shot them, and the government did nothing about it. So anyone that thinks that black people are free, no, they are not. And the lack of freedom is directly the result of Mandela selling them out. So if you want a hero, Mandela is a hero, but not Nelson Mandela. Winnie Mandela is the hero of that family, and that's what split them up. And we need to be aware of what...
Here's the thing. History is a very, very complicated thing, because history also is about interpretation of facts and reality. By the way, Winnie Mandela is to be buried tomorrow. I'm sure the entire country will pay her their respects.
They should. One more thing on Winnie. Just one more thing. Nelson, and you know, people think that you know she was the first lady. They were estranged at that point, and they were estranged because of what Nelson had done. That, and we will never really know Winnie's story. Like you said, you know, she made this mistake, she made that mistake. We will never, ever know Winnie's story for real, because we're only going by the propaganda that the news media gave us, which you know you can't believe that. And Winnie's not talking. She has never spoken about herself. Whenever you see an interview with her, she always said, we. And she said directly, I don't ever speak about I. There is no I. It's only we. So because she's not talking, and Nelson wasn't talking, and I can understand why, because the truth really paints him in a really bad light, we will never really know the real story of Winnie. So anything we've been told, oh, she did this, she did that, she was a bad person, it was a war. And these people were killing their children and killing them. So if there was some violence, yeah, that's the only way you get out of being oppressed. That's how the Haitians did it. They had to drive the French out. That's how you do it. If you don't drive them out and you allow them to stay and you allow them to keep ownership of everything and you get to act like you're free because you can vote. Oh, look, we're free. We can vote. That's not freedom. That's not freedom.
Well, you know, the thing
Winnie's problem with
the history is that there are different views depending on where on the spectrum you happen to be. Are you there as a participant in history? You will have a different view. Are you there as an observer of history? You will have another view. Are you depending on the reports of history by people who have a vested interest in taking one side or another? That's
yes.
A whole other view.
Yes.
I agree with you with the idea that we will have to appreciate Winnie from Winnie's point of view. And you're correct. She hasn't spoken. She had not spoken frequently about her personal point of view, except for the large picture. She clearly was for the continuation of an armed struggle. She was very clear about that. But
yeah.
I don't think we have enough knowledge as to what it is that what did Winnie see about the future of South Africa? And what were the strategies in her mind that should have been put in place? So this is what I'm saying. In a situation of war, let's take a look at Golda Meir of Israel, smack dab in the middle of a war. We do not hear major criticisms of Golda Meir.
No, we don't.
We don't hear about that. We don't hear about other women in a state of war and the choices they had to make. We've had recent examples of that, whether it is Indira Gandhi or Margaret Thatcher. We don't know the full story.
Which goes
we know
to my
some
original
of it,
point.
But we don't know enough of what it takes to emerge. What do you do as a quote leader, a person of some degree of influence? How do you guide a revolution and not make mistakes? How do you accomplish that?
How do you accomplish
and
that?
The expectation of perfection. The expectation of perfection will come from people who don't understand what a war of revolution is. They don't understand it. They don't understand war. They don't understand
particularly
the war of people going up, black people and brown people.
I
going
would say
up
to
against
that.
Entrenched oppression. They don't understand that. And getting support from the major nations around the world to literally zero in and help an apartheid regime. No, we don't understand that. We don't understand it, plain and simple.
I would say to that, in a war where you're trying to liberate yourself in your country, there is only one result that can be taken, and that result is you have to drive the oppressor out of your country and take your country back 100%. That is the only result that is acceptable. That's the only result that is acceptable.
Well, you see, this is my point. This would be according – this is your view.
That's my view.
You would be surprised that in the middle of a war for freedom, there are still other views. And this is part of the complication. There are people who are, have all kinds of thinking about what they should do and how it should happen. They're not of one mind that, okay, we must get rid, get them out of here. Not everybody thought that.
Yes, that's true. But I would say this, if we look at history, and history is the best teacher, the only time that people have gotten freedom in a situation like that is the way I'm saying. I mean, the Haitians didn't say, okay, French, you are slave masters. You can stay here. You can own everything. And you let us vote and, you know, act like we're free, and that'll be good. No, they drove them out. And that's what Winnie wanted to do. If not drive them out, all right, you can stay. But it's our country, our resources. It reverts, the land is ours. It all reverts back to us because it is ours, and we're the majority. It's our country. You're interlopers. And that's the only thing that's going to work.
You're saying, go ahead and keep everything,
and we forgive you. I mean, that's
no, but I'm trying to bring to your attention that you're saying this outside of the heat of the situation. You're saying
Nelson Mandela wasn't under any heat, is what I'm saying.
Nelson Mandela was basically a toady to the apartheid regime. I don't think that is a fair assessment.
You should watch the movie.
Have you seen Mandela and the Crook? I don't go to the movies to get my information.
This is really the only place you're going to get this information, and it's based on in interviews with Mandela, and he was alive when it came out, so he certainly didn't say, "Well, that's incorrect," and.
Sidney
Poitier is intimately involved in it, I mean, Sidney Poitier isn't exactly a guy that we can't put some credibility on. I think we can attribute some credibility to this particular man in America amongst black people.
I'm saying a movie is a movie. No matter, it's got a finite amount of time to tell a story, and there will be natural prejudices and biases in a movie.
Well, what I'm saying is,
let me just say this.
Go ahead.
It's important for us when we start analyzing. It is way too early, in a sense, because we do not have the kind of information that we need to be conclusive about certain things. We also discount the fact that this was a married couple. So there's that dynamic of a strong man having a very strong wife and their relationship having to do not just with a personal connection, but a political connection. There are so many aspects here that we do not understand. We do not yet know. So we will have to give ourselves some time.
Let's deal with what we do know for a fact. There are a few things that we know as fact.
What I'm saying is what we know is incomplete.
But we do not know all that we need to know to fully appreciate what was going on there. We do know that Winnie was against that deal and that she believed to continue armed struggle. We do know that for a fact. And we do know that Nelson Mandela presided over a deal to let the white South African government keep ownership of all the economic resources and land, and also to have a big deal of forgiving them. I mean, how? That's just ridiculous. I mean, no one would ask the Jews to have a thing where we're going to have a whole thing where we forgive the Nazis. They had trials. There was no, okay, let's forgive the Nazis and let them keep everything and let's all get along. That's just ridiculous. That was a ridiculous deal to make, and it disgusted Winnie, and it disgusts me.
Right, and it would disgust anybody who understands what oppression is and how it is done, you know, as a complete process of domination. But I'm saying just the same. Even now, there are so many pieces of this puzzle that are missing and unaccounted for. And we would do ourselves and history a disservice by using a few things, a few facts here, a few facts there, to comprise the totality of what we ought to think. No, we are not close to having all that information. We're not. We can come to a conclusion about certain aspects of it, absolutely. But to extrapolate and say, on the basis of these five facts, we can draw conclusive opinions about what the history of South Africa. No, we can't.
Well,
because the history of South Africa has a long way to go still to be exposed, to be understood, to be discovered. It hasn't yet filled out to the extent that we ought to. It's like people making, coming to conclusions about African history. Look, the surface has only been scratched. And the people who would tell you that are the historians themselves. They can give you a definitive reading about certain aspects of African history, but the history of Africa can't yet be told, has not yet been told. What we think we know is but a fraction of what is to be known. So we should be careful to say, let's take a look at A, B, C, D, E, and we could look at these facts, lift them out of the context of history, really, and we could come to some conclusions about these things. But that in no way should represent the totality of the history of anything.
Yes, I do. And all I'm giving you, the only thing I can ever give you or anyone can ever give you is their opinion. Everything is opinion, and I'm calling with my opinion. And my opinion, based on what I see, the facts that I have that are available, of course, they're not all available, but based on the facts that I have, what I know to be true, and what I see currently happening and the results of those moves, brings back around to how I started this conversation. Winnie Mandela, hero. Nelson Mandela, sellout, not a hero.
Okay.
If there's statues, there should be a statue of Winnie, not a statue of Nelson.
I'll still maintain that we have a lot more to learn and a lot more to know. We do not know nearly what the totality of this situation. We don't. We have a window here and a window there into what's going on. But the struggle isn't just Winnie and Nelson Mandela. You have all these people who were part of the struggle, who were dead, who were killed, martyred. We have no idea what their views were. We have no idea how they saw things. And this was a very dynamic situation. We look at and we say, and I think incorrectly, we clear that Winnie Mandela, Nelson Mandela were prominent, but they were not the struggle. There are a lot of people we don't even know who were brutally murdered because of political differences and so forth. They were targeted and all kinds of reasons why they were killed. But we have no appreciation. We don't have a well-rounded appreciation of what the struggle was, how people literally fought to arrive at some kind of consensus, not about, well, should we be free or should we not be free? That wasn't the issue. The issue is, how do we work toward liberation? Not ever having a blueprint. They don't have a rule book, as in all revolutions. It's a process of that occurs over time, and people talking it through. People disagreeing, sometimes quite violently. We don't have the full spectrum of what the debates were and how people evaluated their situation themselves. That's a very important part. So it's not about Winnie and Nelson. That too is a distortion. And you were quite correct when you said that Winnie Mandela always talked about the we of things. Well, that's a great insight. But at the same time, it does not give us the history of South Africa. It gives us a piece of it. We now have to find out what we can, because this is the role of the historians. They have to dig and tell us what the issues were, how they unfolded. How did these people who had never ruled a country and whose history was deeply enmeshed in oppression, how did they cope? Where did they get their ideas from? And how did they begin to work towards some kind of consensus? That's a major historical effort right there. So less about comparing Winnie and Nelson, more about understanding Winnie in her own right, Nelson in his own right, Thabo Mbeki and all the others in their own right, and coming together. That's the fascinating part of history. People who have, and these were quite intellectual people, how did these intellectuals see the formation or the possibility of forming a country under their own rule? That's the biggest historical document ever. But you raised fantastic points today. I thank you for your contribution today. 888-874-4888. We have Patricia from New York next.
Good afternoon, Eutrice, and good afternoon to the PRN family. It's going to be a beautiful weekend, so I hope everyone enjoys it in the spirit.
Thank you.
Two interesting things. Over a few days ago, actually yesterday, there was a police officer in Massachusetts out on the Cape who was actually shot and killed by a gentleman, a Caucasian gentleman, and during the process of the police officer serving a warrant on him. And it was very interesting. This person barricaded himself in his home, and he's still alive. He was captured, and he's still alive. Contrary to what would have happened to someone of melanin who had actually killed a police officer. So I say that to say that in terms of how we respond to police killings, not only do I hear a sense of despair and hopelessness when I listen to these shows, these Sunday shows, when people call in, it's as if they have absolutely no sense of strength, no sense of power, no sense of direction, no sense of anything. And so last week, you know me. Sunday's my day. I try to do as much as I can, and I chose a different Sunday show to call in on. And I, you know, as everybody says, all politics is local, and as you know, I'm really embroiled in this Cuomo reelection campaign. And while I might not involve myself in electoral politics, unfortunately, most black and brown people do. And they do so without thinking about what they are doing and why. And so I said to the individual who was the host of the show, look, Cuomo is going into every black church that will allow him entry. And he is doing everything to try and garner the thousands of black people who have kept him in office for 8 years. Even though he has ignored them for 8 years, he couldn't be in office without them. And so I said to him, every black person needs to, at this particular point, demonstrate that they do have some backbone. And in this time when they have a choice, choose other than Cuomo, anybody other than Cuomo, if for no other reason than to prove that they too can respond to their own condition. And I was really hurt and disappointed when I heard thank you and the next caller. I thought I would have received a response to my comments, and there were none from the host of the show. And I was actually surprised at that, because this particular host, the reason I chose this particular show is because this particular host is the president of a union that is having considerable difficulty, not only with de Blasio, but with Cuomo. And I thought he would have welcomed my comments. But much to my surprise, he did not. And so I say to myself, we really are at the point where we are reduced to whining. We whine about our condition. We lament our condition. But at no point are we able to say there is a solution, because I have two solutions in terms of my local politics this year. Get Cuomo out of office, if for no other reason to demonstrate that we've got strength and power. And then I say to people, if every black person who went to see, I can't even think of that movie, Black whatever, the movie, what is the name of the movie?
The Black Panther?
God, see, can't even call the name, Black Panther. Do you realize if every person who had gone to see Black Panther had contributed just $1, just $1, we could have capitalized a bank that could respond to the needs of the black and brown community, as we are now seeing the whole banking industry reinvent themselves and reintroduce subprime mortgages that contributed to black people losing their one investment they had, which were their homes. So those are two solutions that we could do today, with minimal effort, not asking for $100, just $1. From every person who went to see Black Panther, capitalize a black bank, capitalize an internet black bank, because you don't need a brick and mortar bank today. Everything is done online. Why can't we do that?
Well, you asked a question. What do you think the answer might be?
We are waiting on someone else to fight our battles. We don't realize. You see, Winnie understood. We're looking to the wrong people, asking the wrong questions, knocking on the wrong doors. We have no internal capacity for initiative because we don't recognize our own strength and our own power. So today, normally I'm very upbeat, but I'm not today.
Well, today, it is because you're dealing with reality in a different way. I mean, and this is, I think, a very vital part of how we become activists. We have to look at reality. That was my talk yesterday. We have to look at the reality of our condition, what we are dealing with, including our own pathologies, our own resistance to working in our own interests. This is very much a part of our reality. We don't need to brush it under a rug, and we don't need to suggest that, you know, the world is responsible for everything that we are suffering from. No, very much the case. It's very much the case that many of the things that we are doing are so counterintuitive, so counterproductive, but we are doing them without regard for the consequences or likely consequences of these things that we're doing. And your points make such good sense. I've been talking about it, as you know, for quite some time, about the importance of supporting community-based banks, small banks, black banks, union banks, whatever it is that you can find outside of the big banking industry. To change your thinking about that is a great thing to do. But we won't do it. We won't do it. And this is the question. This is the eternal question, Patricia. The idea is you have to educate people, and there will be resistance to that. You can tell people until you turn blue why it is important to support local black, a small black bank. You know, they wouldn't do it. So we have a long way to go.
Yeah.
And even though you're a little bit depressed today, the good thing about your depression, if I could say it this way, is that it is rooted in reality. This is what is happening. And it's not a bad thing to come face to face with it. Not a bad thing at all. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
You too. Henry from Chicago. What's happening in Chicago?
Hey, Utrecht, how's it going?
Okay. How's by you?
It was nice and warm, but now it's starting to get cold again, so...
Well, it is Chicago.
I know. Listen, I was planning on calling today, but after I heard the gentleman talk about Nelson Mandela, I have to give my two cents in regards to it. It really burns my ears when I hear somebody call Nelson Mandela a sellout. And, I mean, yes, he's made some mistakes, but you have to take into consideration what this man has been through. He was in prison. Now, you know, whether he was in prison for 21 years or 27 years, that doesn't make a difference. If you would read his autobiography, not a movie, read his autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom, he talks about those conditions that he had experienced in prison, and they were horrible. I mean, you have the guards urinating on the prisoners. What do you think that would do to a man if he has to endure that for 21 years, for 27 years, whatever years that he would have to endure that? And you look at prison. Now, I've visited a prison. I've never been to prison. I know people who have been to prison. But the thing is that it changes them. It changes them dramatically because in prison you are being tortured. And so with Mandela being in prison, we have to take that into consideration why he changed. So I don't know why people don't take that into consideration, because you look at a guy like Huey P. Newton, the leader of the Black Panther Party. When he went to prison for 3 years, he suddenly changed. And that's the thing about it. Prison it's a place where especially black men get tortured. So we cannot sit here and call Mandela a sellout because of the fact that the conditions that he was under was just atrocious. And when you're in those conditions, you are not in your right mind. Now, like I said, I don't excuse that for Mandela, but the thing is that we have to understand what he has gone through. So I really take umbrage when people say that. Yes, he has made some mistakes. He made some compromises. But this guy was in prison. And then the thing, too, if he did not go to prison, all right, the struggle in South Africa would have never been internationalized, because that's what really internationalized the South African struggle. So he gave up his life for the struggle. Now, mind you, like I said, most people think that he kind of died after he went to prison. And in some cases, with a lot of black men, that's what normally happens, because even when you get out of prison, you know, especially in this country, their lives are over, because with a prison record, you can't get a job. You know, it's hard to acclimate yourself into life when you spend all those years in prison. So, yeah, I didn't plan on calling, but it just really irks me when people say that and not look at the historical aspect critically, like you had mentioned, because we don't know everything. We don't know everything about what Mandela had to go through. So I was just calling to you basically say that.
Well, okay. You said it. Thanks so much, Henry, for your call. And I hope you have a good weekend. Thank you. From Michigan, Leona, you're on the air.
Greetings, Patrice. Thanks for taking my call. I'll be brief. Can you hear me okay?
I'm okay.
Monday. Okay, good. Last Monday was the 120th anniversary of the birth of Paul Robeson. He lived from April 9th, 1898 to January 23, 1976. I'd like to free my mind by sharing a tribute to Paul Robeson written by Lewis Clayton Jones, Esquire. It was out of his book of 1981 called Enough is Enough. It's four paragraphs, and I know time is short. So here we go. From Lewis Clayton Jones, he says, "One watches with restrained anger as a nation of hypocrites grudgingly acknowledges the passing of a 20th century phenomenon. Paul Robeson was an all-American athlete, Shakespearean actor, basso profundo, linguist, scholar, lawyer, and activist. He was all these things and more. I suspect, however, that the essential Paul Robeson is to be found in the uses to which he put his massive intellect. At bottom, he was an intellectual activist possessed of impeccable academic credentials. He earned his Phi Beta Kappa key at Rutgers along with his All-American status as a football player. His law degree was earned with honors at Columbia, and he was well on his way to a successful career as a corporation lawyer when the concert stage and theater captured his interest. That Paul Robeson was a great artist is indisputable. While the depth of his talents assured his preeminence as an artist, it was the breadth of his commitment to the poor and disadvantaged of the world and the quality of mind and character brought to bear on that commitment that assured his stature as one of the few great men of our time. Despite the opprobrium of a hysterical nation in the 50s, Paul Robeson never bowed. He knew exactly who he was and understood that his vision was too keen and far too broad for the minds of the parochial midgets who sought to cripple him. While most of us were seeing communist threats behind every closed door, Paul Robeson was viewing the world as an interdependent whole. He was 25 years ahead of us in advocating detente with the Soviet Union and lost his passport for it. He campaigned for a free and independent Africa and was stoned by a white mob in Peekskill. He protested the idiocy of American racism throughout the world and watched his income dwindle from $100,000 to $6,000 per year. Through it all, Paul Robeson remained true to his commitment and consistent in the enunciation of his views. He retained his status as a citizen of the world, equally at home in Paris, London, Prague, Washington, Moscow, or Harlem, advocating all the while a world order based on justice and the fundamental dignity of every human being. Let us be grateful that we were privileged to live in his time. That's it. That's from Lewis Clayton Jones, 1981, Enough is Enough. a collection of articles, letters, and speeches of Lewis Clayton Jones. I also want to add real quick that Paul Robeson's autobiography, Here I Stand, Chapter 5, The Negro in Action, is still applicable today. That's all I wanted to share. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. And that brings us to the end of our program. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. You should have a restorative weekend. Restore yourselves mentally, especially mentally, you know, psychologically. Bring yourself back to some degree of stasis, because next week begins shortly after that. We'll see each other on Monday, and thank you so much, all of you, for your considered opinions today. Bye-bye.